is nowhere.
All right, man. Welcome to Crow 777 Radio. This is episode 563. It's me and Jason today, and we're going to get into the history of advertising. You know, I've had a number of jobs that probably could have come under the heading of marketing. And while I was doing it back probably in the 90s, certainly in the 90s, late 90s, particularly when the first internet advertising and the banner ad was being developed, I never really gave it much thought. I was worried with the technology of it. How do we do this? How do we make it work? All these things. But if you consider what marketing is, it's basically trying to, and coerce probably isn't the right word, but I'll use it anyhow because you know what I'm saying. It's to coerce someone into taking an action they would not have otherwise taken. It's a manipulation. And this has been known forever. Think of back when TV was early and someone figured out that we can pay for this whole thing, lock, stock, and barrel, if we get Jif peanut butter, Peter Pan peanut butter, or someone to pay us money to simply get their product out in front of eyeballs. Anyhow, welcome, Jason.
And a ridiculously cold good morning.
Yeah, I am kind of a mind that what we have just witnessed is another version of population control. Here in Rhode Island, we have not had a winter. Today is the first real snow, and it's not even a real snow. It's an inch. We've kind of dodged the bullet. But what has happened so far, which has happened the last 2 years, is we've been having days from the 50s to the 70s. We had 70-degree days in December. And it occurred to me that I saw them spraying the sky with chemtrails the whole time that it was warm. So what I'm thinking is probably what's going on is they hold this bulge of heat where it should be winter, and then they quit doing it, and the Arctic air just rushes down all the way almost to where you are. You're in the 20s today in Louisiana in the South, where it's typically doesn't get that cold. Think of all the places right now that are in negative digits. My friends in Michigan, one of my family members in Colorado, all in -6, some down to -10, they were telling me. How many people get killed of all the homeless people that are now in the world? How many people get killed by the weather? And we'll probably never hear about it. I mean, but what do you think? This occurred to me last night. Do you suppose what we're witnessing is more population removal via weather?
Well, it's certainly possible, and this is not survivable. You can't be outside in negative temperatures, prolonged negative temperatures, and have a prayer of making it. I mean, that's just extreme.
No. Even when you get down into the 30s, you're getting in a dangerous, dangerous area if you don't have shelter. And as we all know, homelessness is an epidemic in certain parts of the country, much worse than others. But nonetheless, there are way, way, way more homeless people. And when you start going into negative digits, Fahrenheit, that can kill you. And I suspect that a lot of people are maybe losing their lives. And this is just an educated guess. But anyhow, we should probably focus back on the topic at hand. Anything you want to say about the history of advertising before we jump in?
Well, we didn't focus on any specific individual, even though there were lots of them involved in advertising. This was more of how things built up over time and the techniques used. But of course, there are certain key figures. But if I picked any one of them to focus on, most of the episode would have ended up being on that one particular person. So this is more like the approach to it as opposed to any one person.
Think about the difference between what advertising was in the 90s and what it is now. It's a bit of a scam, to be honest. Think of somewhere like Google or YouTube where they're running the ads. People don't really have an easy way to do oversight. They have to take the word of Google about how many ads were run, you know, how long. They make the rules of what a serve is, you know, how many seconds or whether there's an interaction. It's almost like you got to take their word for all of it. And it is the lion's share, I think, of profit these days is the advertising that's put into internet content. And we'll get into it. I have experience with the very beginnings of this because I was involved in making the first video banner ads that ever went out on the internet for some pretty big places. Anyhow, I guess let's jump in.
Advertising is the techniques and practices used to bring products, services, opinions or causes to public notice for the purpose of persuading the public to respond in a certain way toward what is advertised, with most advertising involving the promotion of a good that is for sale, often through brand marketing. Similar methods are also used to manipulate human behaviors with helpful-sounding suggestions, such as driving safely, supporting various charities, or voting for a particular political candidate or party. In many countries, advertising is the most important source of income for their mainstream media outlets, such as newspapers, magazines, and television stations, through which it is conducted. In the non-communist world, advertising has become a large, important, and highly profitable service industry, with extensive resources being allocated every year to persuade the public in one way or another in an endless barrage of what is, basically put, propaganda.
Well, persuade's a nicer word than I used. I wanted to use coercion, but that's probably not quite fair. It's not far from fair, but it's probably not quite fair. But do you remember when we were doing way, way back some of the earliest Tavistock episodes? I think it was Daniel Estelin who pointed out that there was an ad campaign. I forget what it was. I want to say it was Windows or a computer, but whatever, there was like a 3 or 4 pitch tone that actually was inserted into doorbells that were almost everywhere. And this is the kind of underhanded subconscious psychological manipulation that we see. Now, back in the 70s, there was this big thing about the subconscious targeting of advertising. You can still go see good videos on this today, where things like having the word sex airbrushed into ice cubes for alcohol ads and things like this. This has never stopped. And if you do a search on YouTube and you get good, intelligent channels, you can see all the clever ways that are targeting the subconscious, when in fact, most of what we're going to talk about here is just aiming at your open consciousness.
For any advertisement to be effective, its creation and placement must be based on a knowledge of the public and a skilled use of the available media. Advertising agencies came about to serve to orchestrate complex campaigns whose strategies of media use are based on research into consumer behavior and demographic analysis of the market area. A strategy will combine creativity in the production of the advertising messages with astute scheduling and placement so that the messages are seen by and will have an effect on the people the advertiser most wants to target.
All right, I'll ask you a question that we both know the answer to. As far as we know, who is the greatest marketer of all time?
Edward Bernays would be, in my opinion.
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, there may be others that we're not aware of, but when you take what the force of one man managed to do, he changed our culture and our country in ways that are sweeping, even down to the way that we eat. He added an additional meal to what was typical in America back in the day. Breakfast was something far different than it is for us now. In our overweight communities. But I would go so far to say, Jason, that things like Santa Claus and Christmas are completely constructed on the back of marketing.
Well, yeah, that's absolutely true. Coca-Cola had a lot to do with that.
Yeah, actually they did. And here's a funny thing. If you think about, like, when you were in school, all the things that you were supposedly taught that you can't remember, think of all the advertisement jingles that you heard when you were a kid or the commercials. You can still remember those. So I don't really think there's any arguing on how precisely they're targeted. For you to be able to recall something that you heard when you were maybe, I don't know, 7, 8, 9, 10, how does that work? And I would suggest to you that the manipulation and the targeting is spot on.
Catchy and repetitive.
There it is.
The oldest known methods of advertising, according to mainstream history, date back to the times of ancient Egypt, circa 2000 BC. There, the Egyptians invented outdoor advertising by carving notices into steel. They also used papyrus to make sales messages and hang up wall posters. Looking at the ancient city of Pompeii, as well as in Arabia, commercial messages and political campaign displays have been found in their ruins. Rock paintings or wall paintings for commercial advertising have been found in the ruins of ancient Greece and ancient Rome. This is said to still exist in parts of Africa, Asia, and South America. Looking to ancient China, the earliest advertising known was in an oral form, as recorded in the Classic of Poetry, dated to 11th to 7th centuries BC, which consists of bamboo flutes being played to sell candy. Advertisement usually took in the form of signboards and inked papers with calligraphy written on them. A copper printing plate dated back to the Song Dynasty was used to print posters in the form of a square sheet of paper with a rabbit logo with Jinan Lu's Fine Needle Shop and "We buy high-quality steel rods and make fine-quality needles to be ready for use at home in no time," written above and below. This is considered mainstream history's earliest known and identified printed advertising medium.
All right, just for the record, there was a mention of Pompeii. In my view, Pompeii is closer to Disneyland than it is to an archaeological site. But cutting to the point, even in the 60s when I was young, I can still remember the type of marketing that went on and how much effort and money was put into it. As an example, the earliest bank account I can remember having set up for me, they gave us this little bank. Now, in the 60s, they were already getting a little crappier. If you went back a decade or two, these were metal cast. They're now, a lot of them, very collectible. But there was a lot of effort and craftsmanship put into this gift they would give you just to come in and, you know, use that bank. Times were very different then because in that day, pretty much the customer was right. Whereas when I go into the bank now, everything is completely reversed. And I mention this because I think it has a bearing on the advertisement that we see. Jason, if you thought, I mean, you've covered Bernays like more than anyone I know. If you could list three things that Bernays changed about our country, what would they be? And as a matter of fact, I bet I could guess them before you say them, but what would they be?
Oh, let's see. The breakfast thing, as you mentioned earlier, was huge. Yep. Women smoking and becoming very common was a huge one.
For women.
Yep. And there's a number of things. Dixie cups was a big one.
Well, not to spin wheels. There's way more than three, but these are sweeping changes in American culture. And I agree with you. Probably breakfast is the biggest, but think about the smoking thing, getting women to smoke when it wasn't really socially acceptable, how many lives have been lost. And, you know, anyhow, but Rose is mentioning hairnets and hygiene, but let's keep pushing.
Moving up to the Middle Ages in Europe, towns and cities were growing larger and larger. However, the average person was unable to read. So instead of signs that might read cobbler, miller, tailor, or blacksmith, an image associated with the particular trade would be used, such as a boot, a suit, a hat, a clock, a diamond, a horseshoe, a candle, or a bag of flour. Fresh fruits and vegetables were sold in the city square from the backs of carts and wagons, with their proprietors using street callers, also known as town criers, to announce their current location for the convenience of potential customers.
What you're mentioning here, like when you used to see, I don't know if it's the same thing, putting your shingle up on your new business, but like if it was a fish seller, there would be a picture of a fish on the sign. Now you're tapping into symbols, and symbols are so powerful because they tend to activate both sides of your mind. And to put a fine point on this, consider the barber pole, right? That one has lasted. I mean, you can still go out in any city and you see that barber pole and instantly, you know, it has the effect that it's intended. And how is it that that is even needed anymore, right? We use our phones and everything else if we need a haircut. In this day and age, most people tend to stick with the same barber that they have. And yet the symbol, the barber pole, has been so powerful that it still persists.
Since we are still in the pre-printing era, there are major forms of advertisement which were generally being employed. The first is the signboard, which is the use of commercial signage to indicate what a particular establishment is selling. Today, some signboards applied to inns and taverns have actually survived to modern times across Britain and parts of Europe. The second form of advertising is the use of a trademark, which is the practice of attaching a seal or a mark to products. This practice is thought to go back as far as 4,000 years ago. The last form of advertising is the aforementioned town crier, where individuals were sent around outside to make announcements about vendors and to give news that would be of interest to the locals.
You know, you've all seen the movies where in Rome, there's a town crier and he's telling what the latest dictate is or some other news of the day. And here already, marketing is so important that along with the news of the day or whatever the emperor or the new law that's being announced to everybody by the crier, he's also doing advertising. And you can bet there must have been a, you know, there had to have been a fee attached to that, right? Or everyone would have wanted to be part of the town crier's little show every morning.
Oh, I'm sure there are different criers for different things. Probably one for the actual government of the area, and then the various vendors and all that probably had their own at times.
No doubt. You know, it'd be interesting to actually know what was actually way back, like in ancient Rome, if it existed in any way that we think it did. What a role some of these modern things that we experience all the time actually played. Because commerce, in my mind, is much different than it once was. Right now, commerce is like the excuse for anything. If you are rich enough, you're outside the law. If you are big enough in your corporation, you're basically above government at this time. I think I just heard a statistic. What was it? Was it 5 or 6 billion, 6 companies that are now in the trillions? I think I heard an offhand comment that Microsoft is very close to Apple at this point or some supposed figure, but they're in the trillions. My point being is these are the most powerful places in the world. And one of their main sources of revenue at this point, or a big source of revenue, is advertising.
Well, how many companies, I don't know off the top of my head, but there are quite a few, who have GDPs that are larger than many countries?
That's what I was referencing. I think it's 5 or 6, and they're in the trillions. It's the trillion-dollar club. I think last time I heard, Apple was supposedly on top, but who the hell really knows?
Advancing to the year 1440, a goldsmith in Germany named Johannes Gutenberg invented the movable type printing press. This started the printing revolution. This press was modeled on the design of existing screw presses, which was a single Renaissance movable type printing press, which could produce up to 3,600 pages per workday. This is compared to the 40 or so produced by hand printing, as well as a few that may have been created by hand copying. Gutenberg's newly devised hand mold made possible the precise and rapid creation of metal movable type in large quantities. These two inventions, the hand mold and the movable type printing press, together drastically reduced the cost of printing books, as well as other documents, all throughout Europe. Of course, from this would come all sorts of print media.
Here's kind of an interesting offhand observation. I've mentioned a series. It's like a movie series that was made in Europe. It's called Borgia. There's two versions. There's an American version with Jeremy Irons. That's not the right one. The other one has European actors that most Americans won't be familiar with, but it's about the Pope from the Borgia family. What's interesting, and the only reason I'm bringing this up right now, is because during the course of the story, the first printing press comes into the Vatican. The reason I'm mentioning it is because the person in that episode, most of this is supposed to be historically accurate with the names at least and things like that. The name of the individual put in charge was Orsini. Now, I have it on good authority that one of the oldest and richest families still in existence is a version of the Orsini name, and there it is being attached to the first printing, or one of the first printing presses in the Vatican back in the day.
Advertising resembling a more current day form began to take shape with the advent of newspapers and magazines that began to be published regularly in the 16th and 17th centuries. The very first weekly gazettes are said to have appeared in the city of Venice in the early 16th century. The idea of a weekly publication would then spread across Italy, Germany, and Holland. In Great Britain, the first weekly publications appeared in the 1620s. Their first daily newspaper, the Daily Courant, was published from 1702 to 1735. Almost from their initial beginnings, newspapers are said to have carried advertising, which contributed to the covering of the costs of printing and distribution. The earliest commercial advertisements are said to have promoted books and quack medicines. By the 1650s, with the concept becoming recognized, the variety of products that were being advertised had increased significantly. Continuing advances in printing also allowed retailers and manufacturers to print handbills and trade cards, which could then be handed out in quantity. The earliest trade cards were not actually cards at all. Instead, they were printed on paper and did not include any illustrations. By the coming of the 18th century, however, they were being printed on the more substantial type of cardstock that we would think of today. These typically bore the tradesman's name and address. Before street numbering came into regular use, trade cards would often include long-winded sets of directions on how to locate the store or premises. With the advent of commercial engraving and lithography, illustrations would become a standard feature of even the most humble trade card. Eventually, trade cards would evolve into business cards, which, of course, are still in common use today.
It's interesting that you bring this up. It's almost like the predecessor of the print media that's going to come. But I always wonder, you know, did they know what they had as this developed? As they began to print, did they know the power of what was coming to be? And I think they did. And the reason I think that is because we've covered radio, we've covered television, and they knew. As a matter of fact, I recently heard there was a counterpart making moving picture machines in the era of Lumiere that preceded Lumiere, supposedly, that came up missing, as if someone knew the power of what motion pictures were going to do and they removed him. I don't know if that's true, but what do you think? Do they know the power? I'm all day long going to say when radio came, they knew the power of what they had. When television came, more so. When movies became very mainstream, they knew the power in advance. And I guess I'm of a mind, Jason, as all this is shaping up and we're about to go from things like business cards to print media to advertise, they knew the power before it even got here.
I would think that at least some clever people saw what was very capable of being done with these things.
You know, I think it comes down to that the general public thinks very differently than someone who's in charge does. Like a king or a queen or some important person is always probably thinking about how many people can I get my message to? Whereas the common man or woman, me or you, we don't think about that like almost ever, at least not until the YouTube age. So that's another point that I would say that they absolutely knew the power of what was about to happen and why advertising was going to be important.
And then not just kings and queens, but big business people, CEOs and things like that. I'm sure they're always considering things of this nature.
Well, let's call a spade a spade. What is advertising from a government or a monarch? It's propaganda, isn't it? Yeah, isn't that the right term? And what are we talking about? We're talking about advertising, marketing. That's what propaganda is. It just happens to be untrue, most of it.
Moving into the 19th century, British newspapers in the 1850s and 1860s appealed to the ever-increasing affluent middle class who were seeking out a variety of new products. The advertisements would announce new health remedies as well as fresh foods and beverages. The latest London fashions would be featured in the regional press. The now available repeated advertising permitted manufacturers to begin developing nationally known brand names that would have a much stronger appeal than a generic product. An interesting leadership position in British advertising came to be held by Cope Brothers and Company Tobacco Company, which was founded in the city of Liverpool in 1848 by Thomas and George Cope. Smoking was a very common practice for many centuries, but Cope Brothers innovated the notion with brand names, heavy advertising, and market segmentation, doled out according to social class. One innovative appeal was to health consciousness, with the ads directed at middle-class men that promised that smoke not only checks disease, but preserves the lungs. A rugged, heavy taste was pitched to working men, soldiers, and sailors, while delicately fragrant was part of the appeal to those in the upper class. The packaging was also designed to be attractive, with posters plastered all over to show that smoking was a normal part of English life. And just like in the current day, lobbying was used to undercut any in the anti-tobacco lobby who might try to tarnish their public image, which could, of course, interfere in sales.
You know, when you begin to really carefully examine like what you just said, so we're basically talking about an addiction. Someone who smokes, smokes every day. So whether or not they're actually addicted, I think we can call it an addiction because it's a habit that's occurring every single day. What is the psychological effect of attaching a logo and a brand to that product that you're getting to feed your addiction? But think about the power of film. And I know we're not quite there yet, but consider the 40s and the 50s. When I watch those old movies now, I watch them partially because of the craftsmanship. Most of them are story-driven, and most of the programming doesn't apply per se to the common moment, although some does. But almost every movie, they are pouring an alcoholic drink every time they walk into a house. And there is always a cigarette burning from about 1945 up through the 50s. And I don't think that the effect of that could ever be quantified. But getting back to what you just laid down, putting a simple brand color logo on a thing like cigarettes, the psychological power of that is probably, it's mind-bending. Someone is never going to say, okay, I'll just grab this other color, because day after day after day, this logo and that color has been a part of that addiction.
Thomas James Barrett, who lived from 1841 to 1914, was an English businessman who was the chairman of the soap manufacturer A&F Piers. Thomas Barrett was a pioneer of brand marketing and has been called the father of modern advertising. While working for the Piers Soap Company, Barrett created an effective advertising campaign for the company's products. This involved the use of now common practices such as targeted slogans, images, and phrases. One of his slogans was stated as follows: "Good morning, have you used Piers soap?" This was quite famous in its day and would last into the 20th century. As an advertising tactic, Barrett associated the Piers soap brand with high culture and quality. Barrett introduced many of the key ideas that are behind successful advertising, and these were used by him and widely circulated in his day. He constantly stressed the importance of a strong and exclusive brand image for Piers soap. He would emphasize the product's availability through saturation campaigns. He also understood the importance of constantly reevaluating the market for changing tastes and values, stating in 1907 that tastes change, fashions change, and the advertiser has to change with them. An idea that was effective a generation ago would fall flat, stale, and unprofitable if presented to the public today. Not that the idea of today is always better than the older idea, but it is different. It hits the present taste. All of these ideas would go on to be used in advertising tactics to the present day.
So I think you uncovered the power and the original effort put forward with certain tactic for the Got Milk. Remember how huge the Got Milk campaign was? Well, that's what this is. What you just uncovered is probably the earliest version by A&F Piers, Thomas Barrett, by asking a simple question within the marketing. But let me ask everybody listening a question. We all go shopping and we all, well, it's not an addiction. Maybe it could be called a habit, because we tend to buy the same things when we go into the store, or mostly the same things. And what that means is we have settled on brands. How many times do you pick up any given item, from toilet paper to anything else, based on the brand, the logo, the look of the packaging that you've been doing forever, as opposed to picking up the product and reading the label to try to determine if this other brand might be better right next door to it? And I think that really illustrates the power of branding.
Well, think about packaging, for instance. What is being marketed towards young children is going to look very, very different from something that is marketed to, say, the older generations.
Yeah. And I just thought of this as you were saying that. I used to pay attention to Big Bang because it was right at that time when I realized, with no uncertain terms, that the biggest things that drew in the most eyes were the most valuable to those who want to manipulate minds. And since the Big Bang was the biggest thing going, I used to pay attention to the things that were being said and put forward. And when I do it now, that show from beginning to end is chocked with social programming at a level that is kind of mind-bending. But there's an episode where the autistic guy, I don't know if that's the right thing to call the main character Sheldon, or one of the main characters, kind of autistic, brilliant, but can't get along socially. Anyhow, there's, and I don't remember it exactly, but apparently Raisin Bran, the breakfast cereal, had changed its box. And he makes an offhand comment that was sinister. And I felt it the moment I heard it. Something to the effect of one character saying, oh, get over yourself. All they did was change the picture on your favorite cereal or something like that. And he makes the statement, not only did they hurt me when they changed the branding, they hurt everybody. And immediately I began thinking that with the brand change, what was actually done to the product. And while I've never followed up on that, what you said just spurred me to remember it to the point where my intuition tells me there's something to this. If someone took the time to go back and look at the product at the time Raisin Bran, a national big deal product, was changed, by the way, the sun is in the logo, I think you might be able to find that the nutrition value or something else about it just plummeted when the branding changed. That's an educated guess.
You know, it's interesting. You always bring up Big Bang as an example of things being implanted in television. The actor playing Sheldon is not a mega genius who works in nuclear physics. He's just an actor. That means that there's a team of writers constantly writing these things to insert into these kinds of programs. And you got to wonder why.
Well, I don't got to wonder why, but your point is well taken. Things like Bitcoin were socially engineered into the public mind before they were much of a deal. And what was done was a clever, let's call it what it is, marketing ruse. The geniuses mined some Bitcoin, forgot about it. But hey, if we had that now, it's worth thousands, 10 grand, 20 grand, I forget what it is. So everybody who's watching wants them to find that valuable Bitcoin, which subconsciously is drawing your mind into agreeing that Bitcoin has value and that it's an easy get rich and I should be involved in all the things that you could think about that. But the point is, at the end of the episode, the Bitcoin is actually lost, which is a clever, clever manipulation tactic because the person watching feels the loss in a weird way. But that is one of endless things that I could show you was embedded into that program to first further the social narrative that was about to happen, to include Covidius Minimus. There's an episode when the character Leonard Hofstadter is going to the, wait for it, CERN super collider. Now, in this episode, Sheldon gets sick, and it is absolutely animated out and demonstrated that the way he got the flu was another character, Penny, had breathed on him. And the picture of the little germs is preceding COVID. And they are queuing up, once again, the narrative that is about to happen. And wait for it, they're attaching it to the CERN super collider. There's a whole story there that I doubt we'll ever know. But that super collider is absolutely not doing what they're telling you. Anyhow, we're kind of sidetracking, but people should consider the power of a very, very popular entertainment source and what it's actually used for. And you bet your bottom dollar, there's dudes in there writing into the script what they want seeded into those millions and millions of eyeballs.
In the United States, around the year 1840, Volney B. Palmer set up the first advertising agency in the prominent city of Philadelphia. In 1842, Palmer purchased large amounts of space in various newspapers, which he would procure for a discounted rate, which he would then resell at higher rates to advertisers. The actual advertisement, meaning the copy, the layout, and the artwork, was still created by the company wishing to advertise. Simply put, Palmer operated as a space broker. This sort of situation changed in the later 19th century, however, when the advertising agency of N.W. Ayer & Son was founded in the city of New York in 1869. This agency planned, created, and executed complete advertising campaigns for its customers. They would go on to create a number of memorable slogans for organizations such as AT&T, De Beers, and the U.S. Army. By 1900, the advertising agency firmly established itself as a legitimate and profitable profession.
Think about what we're saying here. This is the 1800s where this begins, bringing us up to 1900. And who are the big players? They are big players. De Beers, who owns the diamond monopoly, among other things, AT&T, and wait for it, the U.S. Army. And by the way, the Army, as of late, has apparently had trouble getting membership like they once did. But if you pay attention to the advertisements that the Army has been running over the last, 15 years, man, when you scrutinize them, it is otherworldly. From the making it look like a video game to the clear representation that the helicopters and things are bombing a U.S. city, on and on it goes with advertising.
Advertising increased dramatically in the United States after the year 1870 as industrialization expanded the supply of manufactured products to an ever-growing market, which was becoming quite large indeed. In order to profit from this higher rate of production, the various industries needed to recruit workers to also be consumers of factory products. This was accomplished through the invention of mass marketing that was designed to influence the population's economic behavior on a much larger scale. Total advertising volume in the United States grew from about $200 million in 1880 to nearly $3 billion by 1920. Around 1914, two-thirds of the top advertisers were now coming from just five industries: 14 food producers, 13 in automobiles and tires, 9 in soap and cosmetics, and 4 in tobacco.
Man, when you boil that down, that paragraph that you just read, it's basically taking what were once considered workers and converting them from just being a worker into a consumer. And once again, you're showing the stranglehold of the rich by the small number of the big places that are doing all the business. And we know it's true. Think of the last name Firestone. Everybody knows it. And that's one example of many. We can even begin to tie things like ketchup, the ketchup baron. What was it? Heinz, I think. If I'm not mistaken, the Heinz brand has a relation to John Kerry, I think, if I remember that correctly.
Direct advertising is when potential customers are directly reached out to, which was considered an expensive option before the advent of the internet. Most of the time, indirect advertising was preferred because it was so much more affordable. Indirect advertising dealt with promoting a product or service in a more subtle way, often with sounding too pushy for sales. Examples of this might be signs or posters in front of a shop or a store. Sears Roebuck & Company was the first company to focus more on a direct advertising approach when they launched their first direct mail campaign in 1892. Sears posted more than 8,000 postcards, which generated 2,000 new orders. This encouraged other organizations to begin allocating more money to advertising budgets.
You know, there's a whole side story to do with Sears and the Sears catalog, which what you're showing is the, you know, the beginnings of all this. The Sears catalog and the Sears industry in this country is a big, I mean, it is a bigger deal than is easy to even illustrate. And how was it done? And well, at a certain point, a catalog went out to everywhere. You could be living in the middle of nowhere in this country, and that was the change. You could open up a catalog with all these advertisements and pictures of things, and you could be living in Bugs Ear, Kansas, and lo and behold, Sears would deliver it to you. And what Jason just read is, you know, the run-up to that kind of marketing power.
Anyone who's younger might not know this, but the concept of the Sears catalog lasted all the way up throughout the 80s, and I don't know how far it got into the 90s because I was an adult by then, but I remember being a little kid in the, the late 70s and then into the 80s, where I'd want to see the Christmas catalog, the huge thick book, and they'd have the new Star Wars toys and the new video games or whatever it happened to be that year that I was into. And all of us young folks were into that. And that was something that had started all the way back in the 19th century.
Sears was a big deal. If my memory is correct, I think it started to tumble quickly in the 90s. But here's one of the things that made Sears so powerful. There was a deal with some of its tools. You know, most of my friends were blue collar. Actually, for some reason, I've known a lot of electricians in my life, even in my family. If your tool got damaged, all you had to do is bring the damaged tool back into Sears. They'd give you a new one. So I literally had a family member who would purposefully damage one of his tools and go swap it in. And everybody loved Sears. And this was one of many reasons. They were always one of the big, what do they call them? Anchor stores.
Yep.
In a mall, there would be one or two or three massive stores they called the anchor stores that held down and guaranteed the mall's place in society. It was typically Sears, JCPenney, which shows up in Back to the Future, by the way, if I'm not mistaken, and Macy's. And Macy's is complicit in so much that we can't even take time to mention it. I think we first covered it when we did transhumanism, because yes, that same Macy's family is involved in that. But Sears was like the king of kings. And if I had to venture a guess, that all started to change maybe when Kmart, the kind of bargain bin thing, started to come around. But I'm reasonably sure that Sears began to plummet quickly in the 90s. And it was like the reigning king in this country for quite some time.
Kmart started taking chunks out of those old school stores. And then Walmart came along and killed Kmart.
Right. And with Kmart, everything was cheaper, literally, not just in price, but it was cheap. Some of it was cheap crap.
Blue light special.
Yeah, that was the blue light special. Exactly. That's what I was going to say. They would have the blue light special. And so it began to undermine the idea of quality. And you're absolutely right. First it was Kmart, then it was Walmart. What Walmart did was the coup de grace.
Advertising would take a whole new turn when radio stations came to be in the 1920s, with more than 30% of the world's population tuning in once radios became readily available. At this time, advertisements started to feel more personalized, since communication was now far more direct between the brand and the potential customer. Radio advertising was launched in 1922, and of course it was a big hit, allowing businesses to convey what became known as their unique selling propositions, or USP, directly to consumers. More and more advertisers started paying radio stations to broadcast their ads to their ever-growing listening audiences. The earliest radio drama series were actually sponsored by soap manufacturers, with the genre becoming known as a soap opera.
There it is, the soap opera. But what does this do, Jason? It shows the power of what owning a radio station is. And that, of course, puts in motion another thing. I think we're going to cover it, right? Are we going to cover the Communications Act of, I think it's 1996, where all the radio, where the laws change in this country, and now they're basically opening the door where one or two entities can own all the radio. But here in 1922, the power of a radio station is coming to be, and a big part of that is advertising, because how are they making their money? Well, how does YouTube make its money? Not a lot different, just the numbers are much bigger now.
In the 1910s and 1920s, advertisers in the United States adopted the doctrine that human instincts could be targeted and harnessed or sublimated into the desire to purchase commodities. At this time, in comes Edward Bernays, who would become very associated with this method and is sometimes called the founder of modern advertising and public relations. Bernays claimed that, quote, "The general principle that men are very largely actuated by motives which they conceal from themselves is as true of mass as of individual psychology. It is evident that the successful propagandist must understand the true motives and not be content to accept the reasons which men give for what they do. So in other words, selling products by appealing to the rational minds of customers, which was the main method used prior to Bernays coming on the scene, was much less effective as opposed to selling products based on the unconscious desires that Bernays felt were the true motivators of human action. The concept of sex sells became a controversial issue, with techniques for titillating and enlarging the audience posing a challenge to conventional morality of the time. Of course, what is considered moral and decent would radically change over time. Tobacco companies became major advertisers to sell more packs of cigarettes and pioneered the new advertising techniques when they hired Edward Bernays to create positive associations with tobacco smoking.
Yeah, and he hit it out of the park and he introduced women, which culturally were not smokers for the most part at that time, into the wonderful world of smoking. But what's in a word? What's in a concept? You pointed out that the human instincts could be targeted and harnessed. And in marketing, once they did that, they attached the word sublimated. And you went on to say that Bernays was one of the early people with the concept of sex sells. So let's go look on dictionary.com. What does sublimate mean? Well, here it is. Number one, psychology, to divert the energy of, and in parentheses, a sexual or other biological impulse from its immediate goal to one of a more acceptable social, moral, or aesthetic nature or use. In chemistry, to sublime a solid substance, extract by this product process, or to refine or purify the substance. There is alchemy going on, and I just attached their little marketing term to chemistry and vis-a-vis alchemy and the way that they're using it.
Well, Edward Bernays is a good place to leave hour one. The techniques that he would introduce out there, people would grab onto and run with like mad. And the techniques that he pioneered are still very much in use by many people today, not just advertising, but in propaganda.
It is astonishing what one man was able to achieve with advertising, marketing. And he was, of course, everyone should always remember, the double nephew of Sigmund Freud. Anyhow, in hour two, we're going to get into some things, but think about this. One of the advertising things that always cracked me up is one of the big campaigns when I was a kid was Campbell's Soup. And what did they say? Good. Everyone has it in their mind. The ad campaign was Campbell's Soup is good. Well, what's funny about that is I think the first time I saw it was in the 80s, some nutritionists took umbrage with good because they were telling you that their food was good when in fact they put it on the top 10 worst foods of all time list because of the salt content. So not only was the advertising doing what it did, it wasn't even anywhere in the ballpark of truth, but for the Campbell's Soup brand alone, think about what's the agent of the system with the white hair's name? Andy Warhol. Okay, everybody knows who Andy Warhol is, and they kind of out him in the Alien movie, Men in Black. They rightly show that he's an agent of the system. But what does he do? He turns a Campbell's Soup label into art that becomes worth millions. And I'm telling you, he's an agent of the system. So why is he doing that? Well, he's doing that to turn what's true on its head. A Campbell's Soup label is not million-dollar art. It's not even good art. It's advertising. So, I mean, you can kind of see what's going on. Anyhow, I'm gonna stop here. We got so much more to get into. Is there anything more you want to add before I wrap it up?
Well, advertising takes on whole new levels once you start getting into the 20th century, and we're going to cover that. And then, once again, takes huge leaps and bounds away from the early days of radio once the internet kicks in.
That's a fact. The world is speeding up, and I think that's a primary. Consider the speed of radio to the speed of internet, and you can kind of see where we are. But that does bring hour one of episode 563 to a close. By the way, Rose just confirmed for me that the Heinz ketchup connection is John's Carey's wife. I guess she's from the Heinz kingdom or whatever. The first hour is free to everybody at crow777radio.com. Members know to log in for the full episode. Members get access to all forums. They can create forums and they get access to all the comments, as well as the ability to download the two-hour film called Shoot the Moon, which covers all my telescope work. And by the way, the solar work alone in that could be a big deal in the coming era. I suspect that it will. Anyhow, with that, I hope to see you logged in as a member for hour two of episode 563, and I would love to wish each and every one of you a happy, healthy, and higher-minded new era, because we're here, baby. There it is, man. Cheers.
Belief is the enemy of knowing.